Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, and Carborough. My name is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer. And each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, which, as you know, is one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we have a website for the program, which you can access at radioinvivo.net. All of our past programs are there on the website, so we hope you will check that out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you'll get right to the podcast site. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well, at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences, research, and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, please visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. This week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to get caught up on what's going on in the biopharmaceutical industry with the president and CEO of one of the Triangle's promising young biotech firms, a company called Transzyme Pharma. Dr. Vipin Garg joined Transzyme as president and CEO in the year 2000 after previously having held executive and technical positions at companies such as Apex Bioscience, DNX Incorporated, Sepracor Incorporated, and BioResponse Incorporated. During his career, he has been involved with a number of financings and liquidity events, including mergers and acquisitions. He received his PhD in biochemistry in 1982 from the University of Adelaide in Australia. Vipin, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thanks, Ernie. It's a pleasure to be here.
With all of your experience in so many aspects of the pharmaceutical industry, I want to get you, as we've discussed, to take the pulse of the business for us today. But first, of course, I'd like to talk about your current enterprise, Transzyme Pharma, which is based in Durham. Can you fill us in on when and how the company got started and its area of specialization?
So Transzyme is a private venture-backed biotechnology company that is focusing on discovering and developing novel breakthrough drugs for unmet medical needs. We really started Transzyme at the end of 1999, early 2000, after the Human Genome Project was mapped. And the idea was to use some of the novel information that came out of the mapping of human genome and discover drugs to modulate or to modify biological systems, if you like, and discover drugs for novel targets that were discovered or that were, you know, mapped with the Human Genome Project. So we've developed a unique chemistry technology that allows us to modulate these targets, either upregulate them or accelerate or increase their activity, or down-regulate them, either decrease their activity. And that's really how you develop drugs for most diseases.
Sure.
So we found a unique technology, chemistry technology, to affect these targets. So the company started with a modest financing in 2000. And since then, we've been relatively successful in making progress. We have raised about $50 million. And our current focus is on diseases of the gastrointestinal tract, or GI diseases, or simply put, diseases of the digestive system. Mm-hmm. And we're also focused on diseases like obesity and other metabolic diseases. We have a couple of drugs that are in human testing in clinical trials, and we've got hopefully very exciting future ahead of us.
That sounds terrific. I understand that your lead compound at this point, which is designated TZP-101.
That is correct.
Has been put on fast-track status by the FDA and has just started phase 2B clinical trials. Where does that put that compound on the road to potentially final approval and commercialization?
So the fast-track designation is really important for us. What it tells us is really what it signifies is that, as I said, we're focused on unmet medical needs. So clearly FDA agrees with our assessment that the particular disease that we're trying to treat here is an unmet medical need. In fact, there is no approved therapy, there is no drug on the market today to treat this condition.
And what is that condition?
And the condition is called gastroparesis, which simply means paralysis of the gut, of the GI tract. So what happens in these patients is that they will take food, they'll ingest food, and it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't move. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it causes nausea and vomiting. They don't want to eat anymore. The meal experience becomes very unpleasant. On top of that, most, if not all, of these patients, they are diabetics. So as you can imagine, in diabetic patients having this condition, it really compromises the overall management of their diabetes.
Sure.
In terms of their glycemic control, which is very important. If they're not eating, you really cannot control their sugar. So it's a very critical condition that needs to be treated. And there was, in fact, a drug for this condition on the market many years ago. But because of side effect profile of that drug, it was approved, it was on the market, it was actually doing about $1 billion in sales per annum, mm-hmm. but was taken off the market in 2000 because of cardiovascular side effects. So suddenly there's really nothing on the market to treat these patients. So FDA recognizes that, and that's why they've given us this fast track designation. What that means is that they will provide expedited review of all our sort of discussions with them. Mm-hmm. And in the end, if we are lucky enough to get to the point of filing for final approval, even there they'll help us and move the drug through quickly because they understand the critical need that the patients have in this particular area.
I see. And I understand that it's also potentially going to be indicated for a condition called postoperative ileus, or POI.
That's right. So that's it. Separate indication. That's more of a question of trying to get the patient out of the hospital faster. Mm-hmm. So it is an important need, but it's not life-threatening. It's not critical in the sense that it's not compromising these patients beyond just keeping them in the hospital longer. But it's the same idea. What happens after surgery, many surgeries, particularly abdominal surgery, invasive surgery, what happens is that our GI tract, because of the trauma that the surgery causes, basically shuts down.
I have been there and done that.
So typically many of these patients end up staying in hospital for 4 to 7 days, where our belief is, or general belief is, that if we were able to restore their GI function mm-hmm. quickly enough, they might be able to get out of the hospital in about 3 to 4 days. So essentially they're staying in the hospital for 2 to 3 days longer than they need to otherwise. So the idea here is to reduce that so that these patients after surgery can recover quickly and can get home quickly. And as you can imagine, that has all sorts of positive implications. There are a number of comorbidities associated with staying in hospital, one of them being, you know, the possibility of catching, or the risk of catching infection the longer you stay in the hospital.
Sure.
So that is the second indication that we are pursuing for this drug.
Yeah, you know, the hospital is the last place you want to be if you're sick, actually, isn't it?
That's right. And you want to get out of there as quickly as you are able to do so. As soon as you feel better, you want to come home.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's very exciting, Vipin. This being a science-oriented program, I would like to get a little bit more detail from you about the proprietary novel discovery technology that TransZyme's product development is based on, which you call MATCH.
So, as I pointed out earlier, one of the issue in, you know, the history of drug discovery is, what, 50 years old now? And really, today we discover drugs pretty much the same way as we did 50 years ago. What we're trying to do is affect the activity of proteins or enzymes or receptors, various names, but they're essentially proteins that are found in our body.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, in most cases, we're trying to find agonists or antagonists. Agonist meaning something that enhances or accelerates or improves the activity of a protein. And an antagonist just does just the opposite. So depending upon the situation, we're trying to increase the activity of certain proteins and peptides and receptors. And in other cases, we're trying to decrease. Now, it's easy to find small molecule drugs for proteins that are simple or peptides and receptors that are simple because you can discover simple molecules and have a chance to modify the activity of proteins and peptides.
So you have a simpler lock and key
mechanism. That's correct. It's a lock and key. If you remember from your, you know, college days, it's enzyme and catalyst, active site of enzyme.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many very complex biological targets, receptors, and it is very hard to change the activity of these receptors with small molecule, with small simple drugs that we use in everyday pharmaceutical discovery. So our technology is unique. It allows us to make what we call as macrocyclic molecules. So these are small molecules. These are like simple pills that you would take, but when they go inside our body sort of views them as much larger than they really are,
mm-hmm.
because they're in the form of a cycle. They're cyclized. And we have a chance to hit many complex targets, find both agonists and antagonists for these targets. And that's exactly what we are doing. For instance, in our GI program, we are hitting novel receptors. One of the receptors that we are hitting is called ghrelin.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very difficult to, there's a lot of data on ghrelin, but all that data was generated using the ghrelin peptide, the actual protein, which is not very conducive to treating patients. I mean, GI patients are not going to take a continuous infusion of a protein to treat the condition. You need to be able to function. It's not an acute situation in most cases, so you need a pill. And our technology allows us to come up with molecules that are small enough so we can give them to patients in a convenient dosage form. But at the same time, they're complex enough that they can affect the activity of these proteins and peptides.
And being such a good fit, apparently, does that have an impact in terms of an advantageous side effect profile?
Yes. So again, in most cases, side effect profile is a function of how much drug you have to give to get the desired activity, or what is known as therapeutic index in the industry. In other words, every drug will have a side effect profile at high enough concentration. I mean, if we take 50 Advil, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, lots of Advil, for instance, one of the most commonly used medication today, or aspirin, what have you, if we take it in large enough quantity, they will also have a side effect profile. So the goal really is to improve the therapeutic index. In other words, the toxic activity would be at a much higher concentration, whereas the advantageous efficacy will be at a lower concentration. So you're exactly right. Because of this, we have very high specificity, which means we have very high activity. So therefore, we think in most cases we can give patients a very small amount of the chemical to bring about the desired benefit, but not high enough dose so that there will be additional side effect or companion side effect to go along with the beneficial activity.
I see. And that's actually the stage TZP-101 is at in testing right now, is dose ranging, is that correct?
So TZP-101 has completed two phase one trials, which mm-hmm. is basically looking at the safety of the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also completed a small phase 2A trial, which means we went into actual patients for the first time and looked at the activity of the drug. And we can, we're very comfortable with that. So we think we've seen a very good overall tolerability in man,
mm-hmm.
and also we've seen very good activity of the drug in man. Now we are going into, as you said, larger studies, and these are dose-ranging studies to really see at what dose we will get the maximum benefit of the drug and what is the side effect profile at that dose. And obviously our hope is that the dose will be low enough that we can have the desired benefit without any side effect profile along with it.
Sure, absolutely. So how many patients will be enrolled in this stage of the clinical trials?
So these are fairly large clinical trials that we are doing, which is sometimes not typical of biotechnology companies. In phase twos, sometimes you can just do 40, 50 patients and get a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
What we wanted to do is to really get a very good handle on our drug. So one of the trials that we are doing for post-operative ileus that has already started, for instance, we will be enrolling anywhere from 200 to 250 patients,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is a small phase 3 trial in many ways.
Sure.
And similarly for gastroparesis, we will be enrolling about 90 to 100 patients. So we're doing fairly large trials. Our goal is to really find a good safety profile, but also a good dose at which we can get the right efficacy. So we're ready to move into phase 3 very quickly rather than have to do additional phase 2 trials before we go into phase 3.
I see, and the larger sample will accommodate that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Vipin, tell us a little bit about these macrocycles. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about these. These are low molecular weight compounds. And I understand that much of what you're doing is based on a library mm-hmm. of these compounds that your company has created and owns. Where did the technology and the library and everything, where did all of this originate, and what does that give you going down the road?
So macrocycles have been around for a long time.
Okay.
The many drugs out there that have been in use, for instance, cyclosporin is a drug that most people know. Mm-hmm. It's a macrocycle.
I see.
Cyclosporin is a very large macrocycle. It's a very complex molecule. So most of the existing macrocyclic drugs, and there are many of them, they were all discovered from what is known as natural product libraries.
Sure.
So again, way back 20 years ago, we found most of our sort of pharmacologically active drugs in natural product libraries.
Mm-hmm. I had a gentleman from RTI on who runs their natural products library.
That is correct. That is correct. But these molecules are very complex, or they can be very complex, particularly if they're macrocycles. The macrocyclic chemistry itself is very complex, and nature is very efficient at synthesizing it.
Mm-hmm.
What is novel, what is unique about what we do is that we have figured out how to make simple macrocycles and do them in a combinatorial fashion. In other words, we can synthesize hundreds of macrocycles very quickly.
Sure.
On demand. And so that's how we have built a library. This library is not a natural products library. It's a synthetic library. In other words, we ourselves synthesized each and every molecule of the library.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what is in the library. Again, if you looked at the structure of cyclosporin, or many of the other natural product macrocycles and looked at our compound, you would say, gee, they are very different. In terms of complexity, our compounds are much simpler, and therefore they're much easier to make them, in proper dosage form, to synthesize them in large quantities in a cost-effective manner, and all the things that you need for developing a successful pharmaceutical product. And our founder, a very well-known professor at the University of Sherbrooke in Canada, really looked at these existing natural compounds and said, gee, is there a way we can make these similar types of compounds but make them in the lab? and make them as we wish, you know, with different properties and characteristics. So that is really the key innovation. That's where our patent comes in. We have a patented technology to make these macrocycles essentially in a laboratory.
That must be a very valuable patent at this point, because it sounds like a very unique library that you have there. I mean, there are loads and loads of these types of libraries for combinatorial chemistry and screening out there, but it sounds like yours is very special.
You're absolutely right. We are just beginning to scratch the surface at this point in terms of what this library can do. We focused initially on targets called GPCRs, which is a very well-known class of targets in the pharmaceutical industry. I won't go into the details of that, but we've already hit GPCRs. So all our targets that we're using today are GPCRs, but now we're moving into kinases and protein-protein interactions, which are all different types of targets that can take us into cancer, into anti-infectives, and so on. So our goal is, now that we have sort of shown the initial utility of this library, that we will expand it into other areas.
I see. So you actually have, is it three other compounds in development at this point?
We have two other compounds officially are in development, and we hope to have a third one later on next year.
I see. So you've got 102 and 103 to go with 101.
We have a compound called 102, which is an oral drug. So it'll be administered orally for chronic diseases where people need to take a pill once a day or twice a day for the rest of their life or for months at a time. And then we have a drug called 201.
Okay.
And 201 is in a way, is the opposite. Essentially, what we are doing at this point is treating motility diseases. You know, motility is the movement of the food through our digestive system. Now, if things move too slow, we'll have problems, motility-related problems. If they move too fast, we'll have problems. So this is where the whole idea of having both agonists and antagonists come into play. In one case, if you want to accelerate motility, we need an agonist to enhance the activity of a receptor. In another case, when we want to reduce the motility, so 201 is an antagonist to treat certain diarrhea-type diseases.
I see.
Particularly acute diarrhea. For instance, in cancer, you know, we've developed a lot of chemotherapeutic agents, and as you know, I'm sure everybody knows, both chemotherapy and radiation therapy, they have side effects because these are such toxic compounds. I mean, yes, we have to treat these patients, otherwise they will not survive the cancer itself. So it's important that we treat the condition. But one of the negative aspects of these treatments is that they have very severe side effects, such that in many cases the therapy has to be stopped. So diarrhea is a side effect, a severe diarrhea. So we think TZP-201 has the potential to treat severe diarrhea that's related to cancer therapy and also HIV therapy, and eventually we'll look into things like infection-related diarrhea and traveler's diarrhea. So again, motility, we're going both ways. In one case, we're trying to slow it down. In another case, we're trying to accelerate it.
Sure. Well, that's fascinating. And where do those other two compounds stand in the pipeline?
So the second drug, TZP-102, we are getting ready to file an IND. In other words, it'll go into human testing soon. We expect to have that started essentially very beginning of 2008. And the third drug, which is 201, is a little bit behind these two, and that should we should be going into man in the second half of 2008.
I see. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Vipin Garg, who is president and CEO of Transzyme Pharma in Durham. Vipin, I know that for a pre-commercial company like yours, and so many others here in the Triangle, I think we have dozens of pharmaceutical and biotech startups, and proud that we do. The money pipeline is just as important to survival and prospering as the product pipeline. You know, it's not enough just to have a good idea and some good intellectual property these days. And obviously, you are a veteran in overseeing that type of business development. How's Transzyme doing in that sense? I understand it's doing pretty well.
Yeah, the good news for us is that money is not an issue at this point. There is a lot of interest in this technology, but it's all driven by how successful our products are going to be in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the beauty of what we do, and it's not just TransZyme, most biotech company, we sort of struggle at the beginning for money because we're very early with our ideas. It's very hard to substantiate our ideas. And you really have to capture people's imagination when you raise your first financing and really, make them dream with you. And if they can understand the dream, they will invest.
Sure.
But later on, as we become more mature, now we have real data. And the entire future of the company is going to depend on the data itself. So we will not run out of money because of lack of, because we cannot be financed. We may run out of money if our technology doesn't work. So the good news is money should not be an issue. It's all driven by how good our products are.
Mm-hmm.
And we will start getting real, large-scale data early next year when we would know how good our drug is in large numbers of patients.
Mm-hmm.
And that would clearly allow us to tell people, it'll be very easy for people to understand what is the value proposition here.
Sure.
We don't operate in crowded markets where there are, five other drugs that we'll be competing with and so on. So again, the benefit of going after novel breakthrough therapies is that if you can get a drug approved, it's pretty clear that there is a market for these drugs.
Sure, because it is in fact an unmet medical need.
Exactly.
That's the fast track status.
That is correct.
So when the data does start coming in from the larger studies, would that be a trigger point for another round of financing at that point?
Well, we're always doing financing because mm-hmm. we need more and more money. So in fact, we've been very fortunate to have very good investors in the company, sort of what we call as blue chip investors who are willing to continue to support the company. When the data comes in, then really we have multiple choices that we'll have to consider at that point. If the data is very good, which is what we are really talking about,
mm-hmm.
we could consider doing an IPO, an initial public offering, and raise significant amount of money to fuel the growth of the company and really additional trials, clinical trials, and so on.
Sure.
But the other option that's on the table, as you know, nowadays pharmaceutical industry is one of the major customer of biotechnology products because of the lack of productive pipeline or lack of drugs in their pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who has good phase 2 data, there'll be lots of big pharmaceutical company that would want to partner with us, take over the development of the drug, and really do a very lucrative deal. I mean, those deals are getting done every day. If the data is good,
right.
people are willing to pay a lot of money for that. And co-develop or develop the drug for you, essentially, and pay royalties and milestones. So really, that puts the company in a totally different stage of development once you have that partner. So that is the other option. So we will consider both those options, and the data will drive how quickly we can finalize one of those two options.
I see. Well, if you went the route of the IPO, would that imply that as things progress, you would be looking at establishing, once something, a product is approved, establishing your own sales force, your own marketing team, et cetera, et cetera?
In either case, even if we do a partnership, we would want to retain some rights to build a long-term business.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you sell the company outright to somebody, which is also a possibility.
Sure.
If you do just a partnership, one of the advantages of what we are doing is that each one of our drug has multiple applications, as we talked about gastroparesis and POI. Similarly, the oral drug has multiple options. So it is easy to carve out certain rights for a small company and really build a sales force around that. For instance, we could market the drug in an acute setting, in a hospital setting. It's easy to build a small sales force and really build a business around that.
Mm-hmm. And have highly specialized sales
force, whereas mm-hmm. our pharmaceutical partner can detail the drug to large markets, gastroenterologists, diabetologists, even primary care physicians, and they can capture much larger market, which is where we wouldn't necessarily be ideally suited. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the question is, what are we trying to build?
Right.
Either we sell the business and provide a return to our investors, or we have to build a business for long term, which means we have to have plans for having some sales and marketing and activity that goes into the commercial arena.
Right. Well, I won't ask you perhaps the obvious question of which one are you in favor of at this point. I guess it much depends on how the data comes back, right?
It much depends upon data as well as various options that are on the table. Mm-hmm. I mean, as the head of the company, my job is to figure out how can we provide best return to all our stakeholders, which
Absolutely.
Is our employees and our investors in the company.
Sure.
And time will tell which is the right option.
Well, and given your vast experience at doing things like this, I'm sure you will make the right decision when the time comes.
And that's a good point, because we've actually had a lot of offers to partner the drug right now. And so far we have resisted doing that,
mm-hmm.
because we, unless you do what I describe as a blockbuster partnership, there's really, you compromise your ability to do a much bigger deal later on if you do the deal sooner.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got enough cash coming into the company that we're not under any pressure to partner our compounds sooner, and our investors are willing to take the risk to see the next set of cards and then decide what to do with the company.
That sounds like a big game at Texas Hold'em.
Well, that's how this business is, any business is done that way.
Sure.
And you have to weigh all your options in the market conditions,
mm-hmm.
and really make the decision based on what is on the table.
And timing is everything, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Well, Vipin, it's been great to learn all about TransZyme, and it's a very promising outlook for the future. We know that the life sciences, such as pharmaceuticals, biotechnology, clinical research organizations, and so on, are vital drivers of the economy here in the Triangle. So as I mentioned earlier, it's important for us to, all of us here, to keep an eye on the big picture of industry trends. And as you know, you had already alluded to, one of the big trends is that the pipelines in the big pharma companies emerging from their own R&D are shrinking, and of course many of their big blockbuster drugs are either gone off patent or getting ready to, and so they are increasingly turning to companies such as yours for innovations, either through licensing or acquisition. Now, do you foresee that business model is going to continue evolve in that direction? Is that where we're going for the foreseeable future?
There is no question in my mind that business model will continue to evolve, simply because you cannot create a pipeline overnight. So you can pretty much look at all of the big pharmaceutical companies, and it's not a secret as to what is in their pipeline. And if you put it together, it becomes very obvious that to sustain or to maintain growth, they need to find drugs to put in their pipeline, late-stage drugs for their pipeline. And they're not there in their existing pipeline. So the only way they're going to be able to sustain that pipeline is by doing more and more partnerships with biotech companies, with smaller companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the smaller companies have been fortunate in the sense that there has been a lot of venture capital available to develop ideas. And not every idea will succeed, but there's so many ideas that are being pursued that even if 10 to 20% of these ideas succeed, they will continue to fuel or they'll continue to provide candidates for the pipelines of the pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, a number of drugs have either gone off patent or are going off patent, and these are really blockbuster drugs that are going off patent. So it takes a lot of effort and a lot of luck to fill that drug with a new candidate.
Sure.
Every day we hear failures coming out of big pharma, and it's not just big pharma, the entire industry, including biotech companies.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the name of the game here is shots on goal. more shots we have on goal, more likelihood that we will have successful blockbuster drugs.
Sure.
And that's what really biotech industry is providing for pharmaceutical industry or for the entire life sciences industry, is more and more shots on goal. And as we do that, we'll have a better chance of filling the pipeline.
What happened to the big pharma pipeline? Obviously all of the big pharmaceutical companies have invested, huge amounts of money in their R&D efforts, large percentages of their incomes over the last, say, 10 years. It doesn't seem as though that investment has worked out, and thus they're turning to folks like you.
Well, that's a multi-billion dollar question. I mean, there are lots of opinions, there are lots of hypotheses floating around as to what happened. But I think really it is multiple things that happened that sort of came together at the same time. And, you can place a little bit of blame at each one of those issues. I mean, first of all, like any industry, the first wave of drug discovery was what I would call it, lower hanging fruit. So it's easier to discover drug. Mm-hmm. But as the diseases that we're trying to cure are more and more complex, just think about obesity. The likelihood that a single magic bullet or a magic pill will, solve obesity is not there.
Right.
So it's a much more complex, it's not a disease. It's really a metabolic state that you're trying to fix. So unlike, coming up with a vaccine or treating a particular microorganism, as a developing an antibiotic, the field is shifting to more complex diseases. The diseases that we're really focused on now are CNS diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so on. The whole industry is focused on that because there's no cure for these things.
Right.
And with the world population aging, and people living longer and longer, we're going to see more and more need to treat these diseases.
Absolutely.
Similarly, a lot of lifestyle diseases, obesity, diabetes, and so on, what we call as the big basket of metabolic diseases and metabolic syndrome, that needs to be treated. Then we still have cancer out there. Mm-hmm. We got lots of new drugs coming for cancer. It's not curable, but we can manage many different cancers. But still, the side effect of these drugs is such that we've created yet another need to treat the side effect profile.
Right.
And then we have the issue of new infections. Infectious diseases have not, we've cured sort of the first wave of infectious diseases. Now there's the risk that we'll have more resistant microorganisms that will need to be treated. So again, everything is getting more and more complex.
Right.
And the cost of, on top of that, the cost of developing drugs has also skyrocketed. What used to take $200 million, 15 years ago, now cost $800 to $1 billion to develop a new drug. So all those things are putting pressure on the entire industry, and therefore it's that much more difficult to come up with new drugs.
Indeed. Well, do you think the big pharma companies are kind of facing the music at this point, that, as you say, they've picked most of the low-hanging fruit, and that perhaps there aren't going to be that many of these blockbuster, multi-billion dollar a year drugs emerging in the near future, and that they need to turn more to niche products to sustain growth?
I think it's both. There will be blockbuster drugs.
Okay.
There is no question about it. I mean, the biggest blockbusters are probably still to come.
Okay.
Again, just think about if one could come up with a treatment for obesity. Mm. I don't have to, anybody can do the math. That would be a huge. As much as we're able to do...
There's a lot of people working on that, too,
right,
aren't
exactly.
There? Yeah.
As much as Alzheimer's is the same way. For some of these diseases, the other issue is going to be more prevention rather than cure.
Mm-hmm.
Because Alzheimer's might be difficult to cure once it's set in. So it may be that we will treat people sort of predisposed or to higher risk of some of these conditions. We'll have to start treating them much earlier in their life cycle, rather than waiting for the disease to take hold.
Sure.
So an Alzheimer's therapy, a vaccine, if you want to think of it that way, is going to be a blockbuster. I mean, as I said, it'll be a blockbuster of the scale we haven't seen yet. Diabetes is the same way. Right now, diabetes market, you know, we can manage diabetes, but we still cannot treat diabetes, and we have to be right on top of it to treat diabetes to really keep patients out of crisis. So at the same time, the niche market is also going to be there. There are lots of different indications. So both of these will continue to grow.
I see. Well, you mentioned prevention, and it certainly seems, and I've been hearing people talk about that for years, and it seems like some of the companies have at least started looking in that direction. But a condition like obesity is, you know, to a great extent, certainly driven by genetic conditions, but is also a disease of lifestyle.
That's correct.
Do you think the pharmaceutical industry will really start getting serious about preventive efforts, and is there a business there?
Well, that's the question. I mean, what can pharmaceutical industry do to educate people? I mean, yes, majority of obesity can be prevented by taking good lifestyle measures from the very early childhood. But that's not the job of the pharmaceutical industry. It's really the job of society at large to educate people and to convince them that you shouldn't. I mean, we've done a great job with smoking. So, I believe these things are doable, but it takes a long time.
Sure.
Meanwhile, obesity is going to be an issue, a major issue, particularly in the U.S., but also, you know, in the rest of the developed world. So the need for an obesity treatment is going to be there, and we're getting there. I mean, there are new drugs coming on the market or very close to. You know, some of them have failed in final stages, but at least they're getting to the point where you can test them. And there are more and more new ideas coming to the market where there is, you know, without a doubt, a strong belief that an effective obesity drug, even, you know, slightly effective, it doesn't have to, you know, cure everybody, if it can have 10-15% difference in obesity, would be a blockbuster drug.
Absolutely, and certainly we appear to be learning more and more about obesity and how complex it is, but what was it last week in the news that a virus may even be involved?
Right.
So it's not like as simple a condition as you eat too much and don't exercise enough.
And therefore the complexity of treating these diseases.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about genomics before we came on the air, and I certainly do want to pursue that. As you mentioned, the promise of the sequencing of the human genome, it appeared that we were right on the brink of a golden age, that was going to solve a lot of seemingly insoluble questions and make everybody healthier and live longer. Hasn't happened yet. What is your take on where we stand with that? Is that promise still there, or are we seeing it's a little bit more complicated than we thought?
Well, I believe the promise is definitely there. It's just that with most of these kind of new discoveries, sort of new frontiers, we expect too much too soon. So this has only been, what, 5, 6, 7 years since we've really mapped the human genome. Mm-hmm. And it's really going to take about 20 years before it's going to have an impact on drug discovery and development. There is already impact in, you know, pharmacogenomics and so-called personalized medicine. There are new diagnostic tests coming up. And so most people would agree that 20 years from now, pharmaceutical practices or healthcare practices will be very different, and all these technologies will play a role. But more specifically, if you look at the pharmaceutical industry, in other words, drug discovery, it really hasn't had much impact on that today. Because what genomics did was sort of flooded the industry or the scientific community with hundreds of thousands of new targets.
Right.
And all we know now is that, well, here, there are more targets we can pursue, but that doesn't simplify life, because we have to take each one of those targets and sort of drill down further to really ask the question, is this really a biologically relevant target? In other words, if we made a change to this protein or this receptor or this peptide, as we talked at the beginning, is that really going to change the course of the disease? And for many of these complex diseases, there are so-called redundant pathways that the evolution or the biology has created. So if you try to block one pathway, there is the biological system will adapt in many ways and will circumvent that particular pathway and still get to the same place where it was, you know, before you blocked that pathway. So really, we're talking about understanding a very complex system. I mean, there's nothing more complex than a living being.
Sure.
And it takes years and years to apply this knowledge. So I believe we're just not ready to get all the advantage. There's no question that the promise that everybody felt, even myself included, 7-8 years ago, hasn't really played out because it just takes that much longer. But over the next 15 to 20 years, we will see a difference, whether it's in the form of more targeted personalized medicine, where you might get a different drug for the same disease than I would, you know, if you go to the doctor, and we'll have a more specific profile of people that would fit a particular drug or not. So right. All those things are yet to come.
I see. And it seems like we're further along towards what you just talked about, the personalized profile aspect of things, knowing your own genetic susceptibilities and being able to adapt to them.
But for each one of these new genes, if you like, we need to develop reliable diagnostic assay. I mean, if you cannot measure something, you really cannot make any decisions about that.
Sure.
And that takes time. So each one of the new diagnostic tests takes time. There are a number of companies trying to develop those. So ultimately, for every pharmaceutical product, for every drug, new drug, there would be a diagnostic test that'll go along with that to really match the drug with the right patient.
As we've seen in the case of, I believe it's Herceptin, was the first drug that was marketed with a diagnostic test because it only will work in a certain subset of breast cancer patients.
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay, Vimen, I'd like to turn our discussion for a little bit to the regulatory atmosphere. What is the atmosphere right now, and how do you see it progressing in the near future? Certainly, we've seen a lot of activity in that arena over the last year or a couple of years. We've had the Vioxx problems, and certainly the diabetes drug that was so much controversy recently. And people talk about the FDA being such a mess, but they've been saying that for as long as I've been following it. Where do you see things right now, and where do you think they're going?
Well, as you pointed out, it's on everybody's mind right now because every day we're learning new facts about drugs. I think part of what we are seeing is really driven by our ability to ask very complex questions that 10 years ago we simply would have never found out about some of these drugs. So ultimately, the question is, what is the risk versus benefit profile of a drug? And we have to ask that question for every drug. Now, there are a number of cancer therapies that have very high risk profile. We know that. Anybody who's gone through a chemotherapy or radiation therapy or any kind of cancer therapy knows that. But you cannot take that same kind of risk if you're treating obesity or if you're treating diabetes, particularly if there are multiple options available. So if you have multiple drugs available to treat that same condition, the question becomes, why should public or consumer be exposed to any risk if that risk is not necessary? And I think a lot of what we are seeing comes from that. One of the things, if I can go back to one of the things that we were talking about earlier, is one of the areas where perhaps pharmaceutical industry has made some mistakes is this focus on what I call me too drugs. So once you develop a new painkiller, a new mechanism of you know, treating pain, everybody wants to develop a similar drug.
Statins
is a good example. Every field, PPI, proton pump inhibitors, which is one of the blockbuster class of drugs. Well, guess what? Every pharmaceutical company has their version of PPI.
Sure.
They're not necessarily that much different from one another. Same thing happened with COX-2 inhibitors, with Vioxx, but you know, other companies had their own version of COX-2 inhibitors.
Mm-hmm.
And one could argue what is really the benefit of a COX-2 inhibitor over naproxen, which has been available for years and years, and ibuprofen and so on. I won't go into that discussion because you're going to hear many different views.
Sure.
But the point is that as we...
And that's when you can be glad we don't take phone calls.
So, because what we're looking for here is just marginal benefit over existing therapy. And when you do that, there could also be marginal risk that comes along with that. And if that happens, that'll kill the drug overnight. So I think that is really the issue.
Mm-hmm.
For diseases where there is critical need and the disease itself is worse than the risk you will be taking, there's no question that FDA is going to take that into account every time, risk versus benefit.
Sure.
And what we hear in sort of popular media every day are really drugs that treat, for which there are multiple options, treatment options, and that treat these large indications with, you know, perhaps marginal benefit. So until we can make a very safe drug for these conditions, there's no question that FDA is going to be very careful either about approving these drugs or if they're on the market continuously looking at these drugs. I mean, another example is Zelnorm, which was a GI drug. Same thing happened to that. So there is always this risk versus benefit equation. And as our technology is improving, we have the ability to ask questions in retrospect and really figure out what a drug did in what patient population. So you're seeing really a culmination of all that.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I think FDA is doing a good job of sorting through it. I mean, one could say, well, how did the drug get approved? Well, when the drug gets approved, you only expose it to a couple of thousand patients.
Right.
When it's on the market, within a couple of years, 100,000 or a million people might take the drug. That database is much more powerful than you can ever do in a clinical trial.
Of course. And so what you're telling us really is that FDA itself is kind of on a learning curve.
Absolutely.
Along with everybody else.
Absolutely. I mean, as new technology becomes available, it shifts the paradigm. It changes how we look at things.
Mm-hmm. I know that they've had to educate themselves on pharmacogenomics is a good example, that it took them a few years to even be able to issue guidelines to the pharmaceutical companies on how to submit their data.
Right.
So it would be understandable for them. So it'll be interesting to see how all that evolves.
And FDA is made up of the same scientists who go to the same universities where other people go.
Right.
So we are
they're
really
no smarter than anybody else.
We learn together.
Right. Well, Vipin, how difficult is it at this point to do business on a global basis? You touched on this earlier, and I'd like to hear your thoughts a little bit more. In terms of gaining approvals in various parts of the world, is that a significant hurdle for companies like yours, or is it, let's get this on the market in the U.S., and then we'll take that step when the time comes?
So what's happening is that most small companies really focus on the FDA because... with everything said a few minutes ago, FDA is still the most reliable, you know, regulatory body around the world, if I can put it that way.
Sure.
So the value of an FDA-approved drug is significantly more than if you got a drug approved in Singapore or China or Japan or a place like that.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, there are really two challenges for a biotech company. One challenge is really getting the drug approved, which means recruiting enough patients to do the testing, phase two and phase three and so on. And what's happening there is that there is no choice but the companies have to go global. So in other words, if we want to recruit patients for most indications in a timely fashion, we have to go to Europe, to Eastern Europe, to Western Europe, to Canada, to India and to China, and because that's where large bodies of you know, people, masses of people live, and you have easy access to patients. In terms of approval itself, most biotech companies focus on the U.S. and perhaps on certain European countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this whole idea of the need to partner the drug with big pharmaceutical company comes into play, because they have infrastructure all over the world.
Sure.
And really, ideally, if you've gotten a drug approved in the U.S., you want that drug approved in rest of the world fairly quickly or as quickly as possible after the U.S. approval.
Of course.
So that's why we seek partnerships. I mean, we seek partnerships for financial benefit, no question about it. But we also seek for regulatory expertise in different parts of the world, and ultimately for sales and marketing, for commercialization capability in these other countries where we would not be able to, you know, build sales forces on our own. So in summary, you know, the global scene is critical to pharmaceutical industry, whether it's a biotech company or a big pharma. Everybody is doing clinical trials now overseas, including India and China. The most latest development is really that there are about 500 clinical trials going on in India and China combined.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they will both issue statements every day. Well, we've now taken over China, and then China, we've taken over India. So there's a big race going on there.
Mm-hmm.
But the more important point is that there are lots of trials being done in India and China. And that really is going to help the speed to market, because we can recruit patients much more quickly. And the regulatory bodies in these countries are willing to work with the equivalent standards, if you like, that exist in the U.S., at least for the clinical trial phase of the discovery.
I see. Well, you touched on an interesting point that I wanted to ask you about. I saw a prediction recently that within perhaps a decade or two, we might actually see a central global drug regulatory entity, kind of a UN of drug regulation. Do you think that would ever happen? And if it did, would it be a good thing?
Well, that would be nice if it did happen.
Yeah.
But we've been talking about it for at least 10 years, if not 20 years. And it's I don't think it's that easy. There are country-specific considerations. There is a lot of harmonization taking place. In other words, there are a lot of different areas where there is uniformity in how different regulatory agencies look at things.
Mm-hmm.
So things are getting better. But the ultimate goal of having one central body is, at least I don't think, is achievable over the next 15 to 20 years. But I could be wrong. But the progress we are making, for instance, today, you can take the package that you submit in the U.S. with the FDA and submit it in many European countries and get a very expedited review of your package, because you've already gotten approval in the U.S. And we're doing a trial in India, for instance, or about to start a trial in India. Same thing, the Indian authorities are allowing now that within 2 to 3 weeks they can approve a protocol if that protocol was already approved in the U.S. That wasn't the case 6 months ago. 6 months ago, they would look at everything, you know, as if...
From scratch.
From scratch, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So things are changing, and I think they will continue to change... they will continue to change for the better in terms of global regulatory environment.
So that's the harmonization you're
talking
about.
That's right. That's the best we can hope for.
Everybody's starting to play off the same page a little
right.
bit. Well, I'm sure that's a very significant development then.
That is a very significant development. And pharmaceutical industry is responsible for sort of driving that development,
mm-hmm.
by going to all these various countries and convincing the regulatory bodies that this is a better way to do things rather than everybody sort of looking at things from scratch. And it also puts pressure at each one of the country to have sufficient staff to review all the applications. So, that's also, it's a necessity. Otherwise, they'll be spending or essentially wasting so much money by building infrastructure to review all these applications that are going to all these countries now.
Right. So we're eliminating redundancies across the world now.
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly.
Well, that is fascinating. Well, Vipin, we are already out of time for the hour. It seems like we've just scratched the surface, so I hope we will get the opportunity to do it again. But I certainly want to thank you for taking the time to come out and give us your take on TransZyme Pharma and the pharmaceutical industry itself.
Thank you. It's been fun talking to you.
And wish you much continued success. And we have got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for the lineup, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the station, we do ask that you make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.